Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
This podcast was recorded Thursday, March 20th at 10:56 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like governments will take a page from pro sports and start selling naming rights to large bodies of water. Why call it the Gulf of America when you can call it the Gulf of Shell Oil? Or instead of Lake Erie, call it Lake Cedar Point. The naming rights could help offset some of those Doge cuts. Let's talk politics. This is Snollig Oster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollig Osters, those shrewd politicians who just can't seem to make anybody happy these days, no matter what they do. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, 5 years after the COVID shutdowns, Republicans embrace the virtual town meeting again, but for different reasons. But first, DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, could be coming to Ohio. Ohio certainly will be affected by President Trump's tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China. And all eyes are on Sherrod Brown. Certainly all Democratic eyes are on the former senator to see if he will run for anything next year. That's the agenda for a roundtable discussion with a panel of experts this week. They are Republican strategist Mark Weaver, Democratic strategist Brian Rothenberg, and State House reporters Andrew Tobias of Signal Statewide and Jesse Balmert of the USA Today Ohio Bureau. We start with DOGE, Ohio. A large portion of the Republicans in the Ohio House have formed their own government efficiency caucus, modeled after President Trump and Elon Musk's DOGE effort in Washington. The informal group of lawmakers wants to make sure state government focuses on what it calls core functions, education, public safety, and infrastructure. The group does not have the same authority as the federal DOGE effort. It cannot demand to see records and start laying off state workers. The Ohio DOGE caucus joins similar efforts in about a dozen states around the country. Jesse Balmert, what's up with this group? Is this just a fiscal conservative group by a different name, or are they really trying to do what they're doing in Washington?
Yeah, I think they're a fiscal conservative group by another name, but the name is very popular and catchy right now, so might as well go with it. I think that it's like a deeply conservative kind of libertarian principle to have less government, limited government. And you've seen the Ohio legislature before talk about reducing regulations or reducing spending. There's a lot of discussion right now about spending on Medicaid and how that could or should be reduced. So this is really just going to be a focus for lawmakers, particularly as we're looking at the two-year budget, but they're not going to be laying off state employees in the same way that Elon Musk's outfit is doing right now.
The members want to focus on education, public safety, and education. Andrew, and as Jesse just mentioned, Medicaid is the biggest item in the budget, so that's healthcare. Are they just going to, is that what they're going to cut, or is it just not important to these folks?
Yeah, I mean, people say, and this is like an old saw in Capitol Square, but it's that beds, meds, and eds, I think is the term. So, but those are the three things. It's prisons, education, and Medicaid. And so you can talk about like reducing headcount here and there, but it's really about those three things. I think Medicaid is probably the most ripe to see cuts just because of what we're seeing out of Washington, talking about block granting the program instead of having it being an open-ended entitlement. So, but there's obviously real-world consequences to that too. So we'll just have to see where things go, but Medicaid, I think, is kind of the biggest place where they both could and possibly could also, you know, would make a difference.
Yeah. Brian, state government has to balance its budget.
Correct.
So there's not as much sort of willful spending on the state side as on the federal side. Can you compare these two efforts?
No, first of all, whose waste, fraud, and abuse? Is it John Kasich's waste, fraud, and abuse because they've been in charge the last 14 years, as Mark always reminds me? Or is it Mike DeWine's, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse? Could it be that it was, you know, Auditor Faber or before that Auditor Yost's waste, fraud, and abuse? Or Senator Houston, who was Lieutenant Governor's waste, fraud, and abuse? It's ridiculous. And on top of that, It's very unpopular, even at a national level in polling. This is going to disappear. It is one of those things that is ridiculous.
That's the question I had for you, Mark, is it is unpopular, at least at first, on the federal level. Could that affect what happens here in the state? Any efforts to really reduce state spending?
Yeah, it depends on how you ask the question. When people see the kind of money we've been spending for ridiculous things around the country, around the world, that polls high. Like, yeah, we shouldn't be spending that money. Remember, I'm old enough to remember, this is not a Donald Trump thing, I'm old enough to remember that Bill Clinton tasked his vice president, Al Gore, with reinventing government, and let's find out the waste, fraud, and abuse. And then Barack Obama tasked his vice president, what was his name again? Oh, Joe Biden. Let's root out waste, fraud, and abuse. You know what's different now is government's more data-driven, and AI can look at data faster, not make the decisions about to cut, but identify potential areas for humans to look at much faster, and so state governments should take advantage of that.
The federal government wants to get out of the education business, Jesse, and leave it to the states and locals. Should the state, is there any talk that the state government should pull back on its Department of Education and just leave it to the local school boards?
Well, I think you saw even in the last couple of years, there's been a move to put state education under the governor's office as opposed with the State Board of Education. And then there's a lot of discussion at the legislature about spending on private school vouchers and so forth. So I think the Ohio lawmakers are going to want to stay engaged in education issues going forward.
Yeah, that's the state provides the accountability. No, because you have test scores that gives parents, residents, and I'm able to compare one district to the next, see how my district compares to one down the street.
But I mean, the whole problem with some of the vouchers is they're not subject to some of those, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse lookbacks. And even when they do have waste, fraud, and abuse, I'm not sure that people pursue it.
Well, one thing Brian's right about is that state governments can have less of this, not just because we have a balanced budget, but also we have state auditors, and currently Keith Faber, who do have auditors go into every unit of government regularly to check, spot check, to make sure things are being done right.
Getting to this blunt force of DOGE, to Mark's point, Brian, we've tried this in the past, and government keeps expanding, 75% in the last 8 or 10 years. Do you need this kind of, a chainsaw approach to really make the change?
No, you don't. I mean, you know, what you need to do is find ways to be efficient and be clear about what you're trying to do, to invest in the people that you have doing the job, and to make sure that they're paid and they have the resources to do what they need to do. That, I think, I would hope in the 14 years that Republicans have had power here, they were trying to do that.
We all want to help people in need. Where we diverge is who's in need and how to help them. And so I would never disparage Democrats and say you don't care about people in need, and I hope you wouldn't do that about Republicans. The quarrel is who's in need and what's the best way to help them, and government ought to be doing it as efficiently as possible.
Politically, Andrew, it's hard to cut. I mean, we've seen it on the federal level where they don't have a balanced budget amendment. They can spend and go into debt. Individual Congress people have projects in their district that they don't want touched, but this person over here doesn't projects they don't want touched, and there's not the willpower to cut spending.
Yeah, and we're already seeing that. The Republicans who have a line of some form to Elon Musk, in contrast, the Democrats have touted saving projects or, you know, facilities that might have been closed. But it goes back to the Medicaid conversation. I'm not a Washington reporter, but that's the largest number that they can actually reduce by making cuts there. And there's some moves that they could make that could potentially trigger Medicaid expansion to be revoked in some states, including Ohio. And you're talking about rural hospitals being affected. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of people losing health coverage. So there are real life consequences to that. Whether it politically gets connected to Republicans, I guess that's a big question for the next couple of years.
That's where these town halls come in. I don't think there's been any really in Ohio yet, Jesse, where the Republican Congress people have had town halls that have had sort of like Tea Party town halls back when Obama was president. That's, they're getting calls anyway, Congress people and senators from Ohio.
Yeah, I know we've reported on the number of calls that both Senators Husted and Moreno have been receiving. And I know there was some national reporting about some guidance to Republican members of Congress not to have town halls. That wasn't my own reporting, yeah. So I'll defer to them.
Yeah, all right. Let's get to our next topic, the now on again tariffs on Mexican and Canadian goods will have a sizable impact on Ohio. Ohio sells more than $21 billion worth of goods to Canada. That's more than any other state. And Ohio buys more than $17 billion worth of goods from Canada. Then you add in that Ohio farmers send more soybeans to China than any other state, or any other country, rather. And Ohio finds itself in the middle of the crossfire of this nascent trade war. An OSU study on the 2017 Trump tariffs found some Ohio businesses benefited, but more were hurt. Mark Weaver, how will these tariffs, they're just beginning, we don't know if they're going to stick, we don't know what the impact is, but it's going to have an impact on Ohio business. Will it benefit or hurt them?
It's hard to say. I'm always a little bit more of a free trader on these issues. But having said that, when countries are not treating America fairly, reciprocal tariffs make sense. Tariffs meant to shield American industry that's not doing well, I don't favor those. But right now, we have trade war started largely by other countries who've been unfairly taxing and tariffing American goods. I think most Americans would rather buy American if they could. We all want to save money. But during COVID, we all learned that a lot of our medicine was coming from China, and a lot of us were worried about that stream coming from China. And so buying locally might be the outcome, which should help a lot of Ohio businesses.
Brian, you worked in Detroit, worked with the United Auto Workers. They're also, what's amazing is we learn how many car parts go across that bridge, back and forth between Canada and the United States and the manufacturing process. Yeah. And each one of those transfers is subject to a tariff, no?
Well, I mean, that's the what Mark said is right about the fact that it has to be well thought out in terms of how you're doing the tariffs. And the problem here is that, like, for instance, in the sake of Canada, it's really a reciprocal trade situation, and they're paying their workers at the same standards we're paying ours, in some cases higher than some of the plants in the South. The problem in Mexico is that they're paying their workers very low wages, and they take advantage of that. So if you had a tariff, for instance, and the UAW's come out in favor of saying we need to fix the tariffs, but if you had a tariff, for example, a reciprocal tariff saying you're not paying your workers the same wage we're paying ours, so we're going to tariff you so that it makes it equal in terms of marketplace, you would create more jobs here. Right now, it's just chaos. It's like tariffs today, no tariffs tomorrow, tariffs here. Oh, we got a fentanyl problem in Canada, which Canada says we don't.
Yeah. Hey, what are the business groups, farming groups, what are they saying here? Are they fully grasped what this might mean?
I think they're all just, they've raised concerns, but the fact that many of these have been delayed or not implemented, it's sort of hard to, like, it's such a moving target. It's hard to just do anything beyond just express general concern. But, you know, farmers in Ohio export soybeans. You know, Brian was talking about the auto industry here that has parts go back and forth. The governor talked about bourbon barrels that are produced in Jackson County. You know, either we see countries that are blocking the sale, the import of American bourbon. So it's all interconnected. And I think, you know, the business groups probably don't like tariffs, but also they probably don't like the uncertainty right now.
It's a long play because Trump wants these tariffs to try to boost American manufacturing. But American manufacturing is going to take more than 3 years to build auto plants in Ohio or in Indiana. Does the public have the patience to deal with a little bit of pain right now, higher prices, but, you know, 5 years down the road, there might be an auto plant that gives jobs?
It's hard to say. It's also hard to say if people are going to connect, like, hey, I have to pay more for this product, and it's because of this tariff that was approved by this administration. And in 3 years, maybe, you know, this plant will be built. So it's a lot of, like, connecting the dots. And to Andrew's point, the uncertainty of when the tariffs are starting, when they're stopping, when they're on hold. That's causing a lot of uncertainty for both individuals and for businesses, and you're seeing that reflected in the stock market.
Yeah, and something I wanted to add, actually, is that tariffs kind of play well politically in that they're spectacular. You can announce them. You can tie them to some tangible development. You can say they're building this factory because of this tariff I announced. But the actual effects are play out over time. They're sort of diffuse. And so, you know, that probably benefits, you know, the politics of something like this.
And I'll tell you this. An auto plant takes a long time to get. It's not just when it gets built. So if you see an auto plant coming up in the next year or two, it takes longer to build those things than just a year or two.
And this is Donald Trump's, he's early in his administration, but he's going to be gone in 3.5 years. We don't know what the next president's going to do. It could be another Republican who keeps the tariffs market, but it could be a Democrat or even a Republican who's more of a free trader.
Yeah, that's the problem. When we change leaders, we get different policies. And it's hard. This is one of the reasons why the stock market's having trouble right now is because most people in business want predictability. They're not really partisans. They just want a predictable thing. And so they were going one way when Biden was in, going one way when Trump is in. This is the nature of a representative democracy.
Ohio has a trade surplus with Canada, if you believe those figures.
I do believe that, you know? Yes.
I mean, so that means NAFTA's working, right?
Well, the USMCA opened the borders much more freely between Canada and Mexico. Now, that was a problem, especially at the UAW, because what happened was you saw a lot of products start to shift up to Canada, because it's much easier to do that than it was even under NAFTA. But that was a Trump agenda item, so.
Yeah, that's he's the one who negotiated that trade agreement, what, 5-6 years ago. All right, our last topic. St. Patrick's Day means we are just a little less than 14 months away from Ohio's 2026 primary. It'll be a crowded ballot. Term limits have opened all of Ohio's top elected spots. Senator John Houston must run to finish J.D. Vance's term. The Republican field seems fairly set with Vivek Ramaswamy and Dave Yost leading the way for the GOP race for governor. But Democrats seem a bit frozen. Former health director Amy Acton is running for governor, but we're all watching to see what Sherrod Brown does. Will he run for governor? Will he challenge John Houston for Senate? Brown wrote a piece for the New Republic last week. It laid out a plan for Democrats to win back working people, but it did not lay out his plans. Brian Rothenberg, what's the word on the street? Is he going to run for something?
It depends who you talk to at which time of day. And, I go back pretty far with Sherrod. He used to come to my parents' house, actually, when I was a teenager, and he was in Congress. But the fact of the matter is he's got the fire in the belly. You can tell that from the op-ed. So if I had to be a betting person, I don't know if it'll be governor or Senate. But it sure seems like he's got that fire in the belly to do it again and to fight on behalf of working Ohioans. So.
Let's put it this way. When it comes to his political fortune, like disco, it's dead. Ohio has moved to the right while Sherrod Brown was there. I predicted he would lose this race to Bernie Moreno. He did lose this race to Bernie Moreno. There was a time when he had significant electoral power in this state. He can't even win the Mahoning Valley anymore. It's just not the. This is the, he's a piece of the past.
Trump won't be on the ballot too in 2026.
It's true, but the Mahoning Valley was moving red even when Trump wasn't on the ballot. Just look at the congressional race up there. That is now a solid red district, and Mahoning County itself is now voting Republican. And so it used to be Sherrod Brown would win the big urban areas and then he'd come in with the Mahoning Valley, and that would outstrip the Republican gains. He can't win the Valley.
What does Amy Acton do? Andrew, would it be Sherrod Brown against Amy Acton? I can't see those two running against each other. Could it be like a John Houston thing where she runs for lieutenant governor on a Brown-Acton ticket?
That's to your point. That's why I have a hard time seeing that happen. Amy Acton's one of her top political people is one of Sherrod Brown's top political people. So I think that I'm sure that what you hear Democrats say is that whatever Sherrod would do if he does decide to run, they'd basically get behind that. So sure, maybe they might join tickets or something like that. But I think that Sherrod Brown has had the opportunity to run for governor in the past. Something that people say always is that he kind of enjoys the work in Washington, D.C., so it kind of makes more sense, especially Democrats, if they have any chance at all of retaking the Senate, probably they have to win in Ohio.
Democrats are kind of frozen, Jesse, until he decides what he's going to do. Alison Russo can't run for governor if Sherrod Brown's going to run for governor.
Yeah, I mean, I do think he still commands quite a bit of air in the Democratic Party and a lot of respect. And so we'll see. I think Amy Acton is running for governor, but her biggest claim to fame is how she handled the COVID-19 pandemic. And that was pretty polarizing. There are people who are still quite upset about that. So it's hard to see how that would work in a primary or maybe general.
That was Jesse Balmert, State House reporter for the USA Today Ohio Network. She was joined by Andrew Tobias, reporter of Signal Statewide, Democratic strategist Brian Rothenberg, and Republican strategist Mark Weaver. We'll be right back.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past 7 days. You know, Republican members of Congress have had some not-so-pleasant experiences at town hall meetings with their constituents recently.
The things that frighten me is the way this insane president talks about Canada as a 51st state. Yeah. taking Panama by force and buying Greenland. How does this person qualify as sane? Why is he not being impeached right now?
That's the reception Congressman Michael Baumgartner got in his home district of Spokane, Washington recently. This is not new. Democratic congresspeople faced Tea Party protesters during the Obama administration. Republicans faced angry crowds during the first Trump administration. And now the protesters are back. And like they did then, members of Congress are learning. To avoid these angry and uncomfortable scenes, they are starting to hold tele-town halls. Republican Congressman Max Miller of suburban Cleveland has announced a telephone town hall meeting on Monday. In a statement, he says it will allow him to reach the maximum number of constituents in a timely and efficient manner. He cites threats of violence against members of Congress as the reason for not holding an in-person meeting. Of course, telephone town halls allow the organizers to pick the constituents who participate and pick the questions they ask, and they can mute anything they don't like. They are very controlled. And again, this is not new. Democrats did the same thing 15 years ago, but for pivoting to a telephone town hall meeting this week, Congressman Max Miller gets our Snollygoster of the Week award. I wonder what the Norman Rockwell painting of a tele-town hall meeting would look like. A working man in a flannel shirt and a leather jacket sitting in front of a laptop with a circle light. It's not the same image portraying freedom of speech. Anyway, that'll do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, and tell your friends about us. For our student producer, Katie Genius, and our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.